Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Dr. Christine Castle. She is president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine and the ABIM Foundation. She was the first woman president of the American College of Physicians, and she's the author of 14 books, including Medicare Matters, What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare, Ethical Patient Care, and A Practical Guide to Aging. And she serves on the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So one of the things that people talk about and that you probably understand far better than most of us is simply the question of why medical care is so expensive. There's a lot of reasons for it, and there are a lot of reasons that people think are true that aren't.
That's right, and it is also the major challenge that our nation faces as we try to expand insurance to cover everyone. There are many different drivers to healthcare costs, and some are just that there are more people and there's more treatments and technologies that more people can use. But some of it also is how we pay for healthcare, and that we pay, from my perspective as a physician, most of American healthcare is paid in a fee-for-service model. So we pay, if you want to think about it this way, for volume rather than value. So if the doctor sees you a lot of times in their office, they get paid for every single one of those visits. If they answer a phone call that makes it possible for you to avoid one of those visits, they lose money. So how there's no real incentive for people to really coordinate care, to get together, to begin to use email and other kinds of electronic systems to give the patient more information, and not because anybody's not wanting to do the right thing, but because their economic model just doesn't support it.
And so you have a situation where a physician, knowing that their patient is not paying out of their pocket, but rather it's coming out of insurance or Medicare or whatever, they don't feel bad about having the patient in 10 times because they make money and the patient doesn't pay themselves except for their deductible.
And that for many patients, the idea is I need to see my doctor. And so we haven't given patients the sort of empowerment that I can make a phone call, I can send an email to my doctor, get an answer to the question that way, and maybe not have to do a test or get an x-ray or a prescription. So you know, it's on both sides. It's kind of the culture of how we think about what's good medical care in this country.
What about just the high-tech aspect of it?
That's a big part of it, too. We have lots of marvelous technology that's really made major new advances in diagnosis and treatment possible. It's all good stuff. But there is very good evidence that we overuse a lot of it, and tests get duplicated. People do the same test. You go to another hospital to get a second opinion or maybe to have a certain kind of procedure. They'll do all the tests over again because it's quicker and easier for them than tracking down the old tests that you had somebody else do. So if we can really get electronic records and get people to take responsibility. By people, I mean your primary care doctor or some physician you choose to be the one who coordinates all that.
Now, we have heard so many stories about inflated costs, like the classic $500 hammers in the Pentagon and so on, but there do seem to be equivalents in healthcare. I mean, the cost of, for example, I was reading when T.R. Reid was here, and he wrote that book about comparative health insurance in different countries.
That was an excellent book.
A great book, yeah. He was on the program a while back when he wrote that book. And, for example, in Japan, medical procedures are cost-regulated, like an automobile repair blue book. So an MRI costs $100.
Right.
And
right.
So ours cost more than 10 times as much. So something's going on.
Well, a lot is going on. There are first of all, there are multiple markets. So when the government pays for something out of Medicare or Medicaid, they do set a certain price for it. But in the private sector, we have a private market in healthcare, and people will pay the best price that they can get. The problem is that unless you're a big healthcare system, let's say where you're trying to get new MRI machines or you're trying to get some kind of very expensive medication, if you're just a small doctor's office or a small hospital that's a standalone, you don't have as much negotiating power with the drug companies or with the technology companies. And so the prices you pay are likely to be higher than people who are in big systems of care. That's one of the reasons why healthcare exchanges, the health insurance exchanges, are going to try to make some of that more transparent, and with the belief that, just like a Blue Book model, that's an excellent model, if consumers, and the consumer can either be you, the patient, or it can be the hospital or the doctor's office who has to buy stuff, if the consumers can see what everybody else is paying, then that makes it a much more real marketplace.
The idea of medical care as a consumer marketplace is in itself something that needs to be really discussed and questioned. For example, I might be in the market for a pair of shoes and I go out comparison shopping, but I'm never in the market for an appendectomy.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And certainly for any major emergency situation, the idea of a market just doesn't work. And I actually have been studying the information. Now we put out a lot of quality of care data, for example. Not just cost needs to be transparent, but quality. And so there are these report cards on hospitals and doctors. Medicare has websites, the Hospital Compare, and now just recently Physician Compare. But also Angie's List is getting into this, and Consumer Reports, and even Zagat's, you know, is rating doctors in California.
No.
Yes. But most people don't go there for, and there's been studies looking at this, don't go there to say, where am I going to find my doctor? Most people ask a friend or a colleague, or if they're lucky enough to know somebody who's in the medical field or a nursing professional, you know, they'll ask that kind of personal advice.
And it's very hard, because to find out whether, let's say, a surgeon has made some horrifying mistakes, and one hears stories like this, a friend of mine once said, whatever you do, don't go to such and such because here's what he did. But it's very hard to find that.
That's one of the things that the new healthcare legislation is trying to make more transparent, that rates of complications or mortality rates or rates of effective care for people with chronic conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure get rated and then become transparent on, maybe on this Physician Compare website. They've just started it, so they don't have that kind of information yet. But some of the health plans, some of the private health plans already do that in their physician directories.
So they can say, don't go to that guy? I mean, they can say this
guy
has
say, click on here. Some of them actually do have, you know, tiered ratings, and that's just beginning to emerge, and whether that's going to be helpful. But another thing is that with, I think, more public information about medical errors and patient safety, that mistakes actually do happen, patients are becoming more empowered when they need an elective operation to ask a doctor, how many of these have you done? What's your complication rate? And, you know, and that's a legitimate question. Every patient who is facing elective surgery should definitely talk to their, you know, to the potential surgeon to get information about their experience with that procedure.
We're talking to Dr. Christine Castle. You wrote an article about this whole question of whether the medical field should become more like a consumer marketplace or not. What are some of the advantages, what are some of the pitfalls of thinking about medicine as a commercial marketplace?
My personal view, and that of many economists, is that you're never going to have a perfect economic marketplace in medical care, for several reasons. One is that it is an uneven playing field. It's not an equal partnership between the consumer, who's the patient, and the provider, the doctor or the hospital. They just, no patient can know everything about medicine, even if they're very internet savvy and they're a smart person. There's a reason why it takes 8 to 12 years to get a medical degree, you know. There's a lot to learn there, a lot of expertise. So when you come to the doctor, it's kind of a fiduciary relationship, like coming to a lawyer has a responsibility to you as their client to give you information in your own best interest. You expect the same thing when you go to a doctor. So the doctor then gives you advice. I think what you're suffering from is diabetes, and I think you need to do this. And then you take that advice, usually. You don't shop, you may shop around for a second opinion, but you're not the one who comes with the diagnosis. The doctor is there to help you know what it is that's your problem and give you advice about what you need. So that's an asymmetry in the relationship that is just, and particularly if people are very ill, if you have a serious cancer or a stroke or, you know, something where you really are not able to make decisions for yourself and you're very vulnerable and scared, then you're really dependent on those persons. So in all those ways, it's not a perfect marketplace. And then you have the issue of insurance, which many, I think, market advocates think is a big problem, that people, quote, don't have any skin in the game is what they call that. I hate that phrase. But, you know, what it means is that you're paying with somebody else's money, so you're not price sensitive about what you're buying. The problem, I think, with that argument is that medical care is just much too expensive to expect people to pay out of pocket the way you do when you buy a car or you go shopping for shoes or something. So there's got to be some kind of insurance system. And if you put too much skin in the game, right now, consumers in the United States actually pay out of pocket an enormous amount of their health care bills because there's these high deductible programs and things like that, co-pays.
And so many people don't have insurance, 50 million people.
50 million people don't have insurance, and many people who have insurance are very inadequately insured. They may have a $10,000 deductible or some very limited payment. I mean, this, you know, some of the low-wage workers have insurance that only covers $2,000 of cost in a year. So, underinsurance is as big a problem as uninsurance in this country. So all those things are not going to make it a perfect marketplace where you can compare it to buying shoes or buying a car. And yet, we do think we need that patients and consumers need to know more about what they're getting, even if it's not going to be a total market phenomenon.
Well, I mean, the other thing is, when you go home with a pair of shoes or with a car, that's a product. But when you go home with your festering boils removed, that's not a product. It's basically a restoration to your previous state of health.
You hope.
You hope. And so what you're buying is basically a kind of a repair and a relationship with the doctor. You're not buying a thing.
Right. So you could say it's like a service. It might be more like if you go for a massage or you go for a haircut or something like that, that you're getting a service rather than a product. But you, I think, just named it perfectly, that really good medical care, especially for people who have any kind of chronic condition, is a relationship. It's about a back and forth. It's about having someone you can go to and answer your questions. It's about having people answer the phone when you call them, and having people know you and know your values so that they can help you make decisions that fit what your values are and what you want out of life. And that is not like a product or even just a one-time service, if you want to think about it that way.
Another thing that you wrote about is the fact that there is a lot of medical care. So one person goes to a specialist here, to their general practitioner there. Maybe an older person is in a nursing home. And these various entities that care for an individual person aren't necessarily talking to each other, and therefore a lot falls between the cracks.
That's right, and that's part of what I was saying earlier about the lack of incentive to coordinate care. So often an elderly patient, I mean, I'm a geriatrician, so I've taken care of lots and lots of very old people, healthy old people, very ill old people, And many of them have 6, 7, 8 different specialists who don't talk to each other. They may be taking multiple medications that may interact with each other, that may be duplicative, that may be outright contraindicated because of the other condition. And that doctor, if they're in a hurry and if they're just treating that one condition, the dermatologist or the cardiologist or the orthopedist or whoever, they may not have all that information. And that's one of the things that leads to more cost, but also to mistakes in care, particularly in the world of nursing homes, where if a patient gets sick in a nursing home and they call 911, put them in an ambulance, send them to the hospital, often the hospital has very limited information about that patient. The patient may not, you know, be able, may not have the mental capacity, they may have Alzheimer's disease or something, and they're not able to tell them everything that that person needs to know. So that's when you get this phenomenon of let's repeat every test.
Right.
And, you know, and those, not only is that expensive, but often those procedures can have their own risks associated with them. And so then you end up getting complications, the person stays in the hospital longer, and, you know, one thing and another leads to both worse care, worse outcomes, and also higher cost. So coordinating care is, to my mind, the number one thing that the healthcare reform bill really tried to focus on. And if we move it ahead and get it right, we'll be able to achieve that.
What are some of the ways to do that? You mentioned electronic medical records.
That's a big one. The federal government, through the Office of the National Coordinator of Health Information Technology, ONC, has put a huge commitment to pay physicians basically bonuses for out of Medicare and Medicaid for the extra money that it's going to cost them to put electronic records in their office and not just buy the machine and use it for billing, but actually use it to improve care. And they call that meaningful use. So if you achieve meaningful use of the electronic information, you get this extra payment over the next 5 years. And a big part of meaningful use is demonstrating that you've used it to coordinate care with other providers, with other specialists, with patients in and out of the hospital.
What are some alternatives to the fee-for-service model that wouldn't incentivize doctors seeing patients multiple times unnecessarily?
There are a number of alternatives that are actually right in front of us in this country and that actually do produce better care. There's very good data about that now. One is a model where physicians are on salary. And we see this, for example, in the Veterans Administration, which has not only salaried physicians, but also has very extensive electronic systems for their patients. And they were one of the first organizations to do that. And they've demonstrated dramatic improvements in coordination of care and quality metrics of all different kinds, patient safety, et cetera. So that's one model. Places like Mayo Clinic, for example, are like that. The doctors are paid by salary, not by number of patients they see. The most obvious different model is a prepaid model, like an HMO, a healthcare system HMO, not an insurance HMO. And the best example of that is Kaiser Permanente, which is a huge system in the United States, covers almost 9 million patients and families, and has the best healthcare quality of any health system. 7 out of the top 10 highest quality performers in the last year were Kaiser hospitals in different regions. And so what they do is they get a monthly payment that either the employer or the patient pays themselves, and then they take care of everything that patient needs with that lump sum amount. And it gives them a lot more flexibility about, instead of saying, oh, this test isn't covered or this medication isn't covered, you, the patient, get to decide with your doctor what you need within this kind of lump sum budget. So the thing that then makes it able to control costs with that is that you have that budget that you're working within, and it gives the system a great incentive to really work to coordinate your care.
Now, when you have that system, then you were limited to the doctors within that group.
That's right. And because those doctors have to be willing to practice in that very intense interaction with other specialists, etc. And so if it's that's one of the challenges for that model, if they don't have a big population. And so the places where Kaiser has been most successful has been in California and Colorado and the Northwest, where they have large numbers of people. So therefore they have large networks of doctors, and they're, you know, it's very convenient. There's one on every corner kind of thing. In places where they have a much smaller number of patients, then it becomes harder because there is a more limited choice of doctors.
And even Kaiser Permanente has been accused of, I mean, they've had situations where they have denied life-saving care to people.
Well, I think that's arguable. The press are always, you know, looking for things like that. And I'm not aware of any specific case of denying potentially life-saving care.
Well, one on Democracy Now, and they got so much flack for it that they then gave the guy the treatment. But
whatever that situation is, I think what we need to do is look at how that happens in the fee-for-service system, where you saw in Arizona on Medicaid, people can't get a kidney transplant.
Right.
Now, in a Kaiser system, they know kidney transplants work
and
prolong life and quality of life. So anybody who needs a kidney transplant gets it. So in the private sector, having all this choice is not so great if you don't have the ability to actually provide the basic coverage that everybody needs.
We're talking to Dr. Christine Castle. So what you're talking about can be described as systems thinking about the healthcare system as a complex system, both the human body and the system that is designed to take care of human beings.
Exactly. And that kind of complexity is something that most people who go to medical school don't learn to think that way. They learn to think in very linear. You know, you learn a lot of science, but you learn the patient comes in, they have this symptom, you do these tests, and if you find this diagnosis, you do this treatment. And they don't think about, well, how do I manage a system? How do I work with the healthcare team? How do I coordinate care? All of those kinds of skills are things that we now need to, I think, expect of providers, and that I'm very involved in trying to make sure that physicians now are also learning those skills along with learning the skills of medical care.
To what extent are physicians, you said they're not really trained to work that way. I had a sick dog, and I continually took it to Smith Veterinary Hospital around the corner, and the care was absolutely superb, both their diagnostics and their treatment, because there was a team of vets there who were continually conferring with one another, and they had different specialties, but they were all, to some extent, generalists, and to the point where I said to them, listen, if I get sick, I'm going to Smith Vet. They said, no, you're not allowed to. But that model hasn't yet, I mean, it seems like it hasn't yet taken hold among the physicians practicing healthcare, you know, in most places in the United States. What would it take? What would have to be different for physicians to really be conferring with each other, talking with each other, thinking in a systems kind of way?
Well, that's where I think we can see the models in the organized systems like Mayo, like Henry Ford Health System, like Scott and White in Texas, and Kaiser and others. But you're absolutely right. 50% of American physicians practice in groups of less than five, and 20% are still in solo practice. And that's going to, I think, in some way have to change, where they may not move into a employed relationship with a hospital, but they're going to have to develop some kind of virtual networks to achieve this sort of coordination. The Healthcare Reform Act actually has a significant investment in something called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, and their task is to find ways to create incentives and models for physicians to learn that systems thinking, to develop that teamwork, and be able to coordinate care more effectively. the models that they're talking about are, there's two main ones. One's called the patient-centered medical home, where some group of physicians takes responsibility for coordinating, let's say, your care. So it doesn't mean you have to always go there, but it means that they need to know every specialist that you're seeing, every hospitalization that you have, to be the center repository of that information so that they can make sure that your care is coordinated and something doesn't fall between the cracks. The other is called the Accountable Care Organization, ACO, and you're going to be hearing a lot more about that. And they're developing new models of paying systems so that the systems actually have an incentive to do that coordination of care. It isn't that fee-for-service model. It's maybe a global payment or something more like that prepaid model, where if they can reduce unnecessary treatments and reduce even unnecessary hospitalizations, then everybody benefits and it costs less.
There's another aspect to systems thinking, which I think is endlessly fascinating and important, which is the whole question of how the scientific method can be used to study complex interactions. So, for example, we live in a world where there are many environmental toxins, where we take many drugs. Some people are sedentary. Some people are exposed to drugs and alcohol. Some people do yoga. So there are many, many different variables, and the ways in which two good things are far more than have far more benefit than this than the sum or even multiplication of doing each one separately, or two bad things. I remember an example in the uranium mining communities. People who were exposed to uranium mining, who were miners, had a certain risk of cancer, and people who smoked cigarettes have a certain risk of cancer. But those who both smoked cigarettes and did uranium mining had a much higher. Or more. And how do you study multiple variables without isolating each one?
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. The standard scientific method is something called the randomized clinical trial, where you have your control group and then you have your treatment group, and you're isolating just one thing that you're studying, and at the end of 5 years, you have an answer to that question, but you haven't answered any other questions. So the modern data age is really upon us, and this is a report that I co-chaired that was recently delivered to the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology about the modern use of health information technology. So think of it this way. Once we all have our information in some electronic, protected, encrypted system, then it can be de-identified and patterns can then emerge. Researchers can use large data sets to be able to identify those patterns and places where there are hot spots for certain kinds of cancers, let's say, or other kinds of illnesses. It's been used recently. There was a marvelous article in the New Yorker recently called Hot Spotters about a visionary young doctor in Camden, New Jersey, one of the poorest cities in the country, where he used the model to identify where the biggest costs of care were and went there and found patients who were literally costing, in this case, Medicaid, $1 million or $3 million a year because nobody was coordinating their care. And they were in and out of the hospital sometimes hundreds of times in a year. And he was able, by making home visits, by getting social workers to work with them, to have their care be better and to have them cost less and feel better. And the way he identified those people was by using this kind of data mapping.
Very interesting. I think
there's real potential for the new knowledge that we could gain in many dimensions from this kind of data mapping.
And so if you were to really do that if you wanted to make a study, you would have doctors in various places who are in your study ask 50 kinds of questions about the person's lifestyle. You would collect data about the toxins in their environment, their drinking water, whatever, and then you could see how these things work together.
And what's interesting about data, the data mapping way of doing it, is that much of that would come out of your medical record that has your history in it, and did you smoke or not, and for how long and when. But they don't necessarily have to ask you what kind of toxins are in your environment. They have your zip code.
Exactly.
Right? And people can really target knowing what sort of industries are in the area and to be able to draw. Now, those are all what scientists call associations. They don't necessarily prove causality, but they lead the scientific community to be able to ask the right question about, is this really causing that?
Right. And is a combination of things causing that?
Right?
So if you live in a toxic dump, but you eat a whole lot of spinach, it may turn out that,
right.
whatever the thing is.
That would be interesting, right?
Well, and because these are the things, I mean, in a place especially like Santa Fe, where people love to talk about their health and, you know, ad infinitum and take a million supplements and so on, we don't really know how much of each thing we need, if we need it at all, if we're going to take one thing, whether we need another thing to go with it, otherwise it's useless. And that's stuff we really would like to know.
A lot of complementary and alternative medicine is like that, especially because there haven't been as many scientific trials, and because many of the supplements are unregulated, so you don't really know what's in that bottle. I mean, you try to trust who the, you know, manufacturer is, but it's not regulated the way drugs are by the FDA. So it might be possible through the same kind of data mapping, particularly in a community like Santa Fe where people do take a lot of these things, to begin to understand some of those interactions.
Exactly. Now, how have you seen your patients change over the years? I mean, certainly there's a lot of internet savvy patients and so on, but there have been a lot of cultural changes.
There are many, many cultural changes. And for me, as someone who has cared for older people, when I started my career, people were generally not as informed about their own health, particularly older people. They were very comfortable with the paternalistic model of care. What do you think I need, doctor? And, you know, tough decisions, like someone who has a condition like a heart valve problem and they're 90 years old and it's very risky surgery, but if they don't get it, you know they're going to die of it. That's the kind of decision that today I would share all the data with the patient, and the patient and maybe with their family would make a decision. But, you know, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, when I started this work, they would say, what's your advice? What
yeah.
should I do? And those are just gut-wrenching decisions, because it really is such a personal thing for people. So I think that's a big change, that people are willing to engage more actively in those kind of decision-makings. They're also better informed. I think the internet has been great in helping people get access to more information. It has the downside of having too much information, of course, and not having it be filtered, really. So sometimes it's incorrect.
Bad information. Or above all, commercial information.
Yes, exactly. So people don't always know how to navigate through the internet, and I kind of think that that's what's really going to be needed in the next generation, is a more authoritative. Now, some people know that they can go to NIH.org or some of those things, but, you know, most people are just looking for what pops up first on the search engine.
Now, you wrote a book called Medicare Matters, What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare. What can geriatric medicine teach us?
Well, this book was written, of course, before the healthcare reform law was passed, and it is all about just what we've been talking about. It is all about identifying the people, particularly the people who need the most complex care, who have the most complicated problems, and finding ways to coordinate their care, reduce errors, reduce redundancy, and reduce costs and improve outcomes. So what I'm talking about in there is that geriatric medicine, my specialty, knew that decades ago. And when we all trained, we learned how to work in teams, we learned how to coordinate information, we learned to make connections between the nursing home and the hospital. But most specialties, physicians don't learn that. So what the book said is that with the aging of the population and and much, much more complex healthcare, all doctors need to think like geriatricians, need to think in systems, need to think about preventing complications, need to think not just about numbers of treatments, but about, is this something that this patient is really going to benefit from and fits their lifestyle?
We're talking to Dr. Christine Castle. When the whole healthcare and health insurance reform movement was happening, and we had T.R. Reid on the air, as we were talking about before, and one of the things that I thought was fascinating that he pointed out is that there are basically four models for health insurance. One was, if you don't have any health insurance, you pay out of pocket. One is the single-payer system, which is like Medicare. One is socialized medicine, which is like the VA and the Indian Health Service. And one is private insurance. So we have all four of those going.
We have all of them, right.
Which makes our country kind of a mess where this is concerned. What is your best thinking on how to reform that so it really is fair to the patient and most economical to the nation?
I think the real hope that we have is to get these health insurance exchanges to work. Because what they will do is act on behalf of the small consumer who isn't able to negotiate for prices. And they'll let people really see what's the best deal I can get for what I need and still have some individual choice. Now, the most efficient way, actually, of reducing costs and having everybody under a tent is probably some kind of a single-payer system. But in this country, people are not comfortable with that idea. And frankly,
some people aren't.
Some people aren't. That's right. The people in politics, especially, are not comfortable with that idea.
And the insurance companies who stand to lose.
And the other thing is that Medicare, again, because we have so much commercial interest in healthcare, I mean, remember, this, you know, $2.5 trillion item in the economy, there's a lot of people making money in healthcare. It's just a big piece of the economy, a lot of jobs, a lot of products, etc. So Medicare has been, the Congress has not been willing to give Medicare the authority to, for example, do what private insurance pay or what the VA does, decide what medications actually work the best and pay for those and not pay for the expensive ones that may not work any better. Medicare's not allowed to do that by law. So some of the controversy you hear about so-called comparative effectiveness is the fear that it's, quote, going to lead to rationing because it will give you data saying this treatment, it doesn't work as well as this one and it costs more. And so, therefore, I mean, wouldn't you want to know that, right? But I think a lot of people from the industry are worried that it's going to be used to drive decisions that will not favor their part of the industry or somebody else's part of the industry. And many of those people are very influential lobbyists in Washington. So it's very tough. You know, if the single-payer advocates think that Medicare for all is the answer, you've also got to get to the heart of that problem, that Medicare has its limits because it's really governed by Congress.
You are on the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Tell us what that group does.
The President's Council, which is called PCAST, is a group of independent advisors to the President on issues of science and technology. We were appointed by President Obama in April 2009 in an event at the National Academy of Sciences. And he, at that moment, he actually invoked that same Sputnik-era analogy that he did during the State of the Union this year, saying that our nation has fallen way behind in math and science education and that we really need to invest in our science as a driver of innovation for the economy and for progress for our citizens. And to that end, he appointed 20 people, and I'm honored to say I was one of them, to advise him. And the way this works is that we meet every 2 months, almost always that includes a meeting with the president and sometimes the vice president, and we respond to requests for reports on issues that he wants information about. So we don't work for any of the federal agencies. We don't work for Medicare or the CDC or EPA. We work for the president. And so it's a very interesting role in that regard.
What are some of the reports that he's requested?
The very first one was on H1N1 flu, because if you recall, that summer of 2009 was very scary. Everybody was worried there was going to be this pandemic flu. So he gave us a quick turnaround. You know, we had to, in basically 6 to 8 weeks, come up with a report that said, what kind of vaccine is needed? How can we get it out quickly? Who should be the high priority people to be vaccinated, et cetera? So that was our first report. Thankfully, that epidemic was not as bad as we feared, and
right.
So some of our recommendations didn't need to be implemented. But he then, this president is very smart, the next question he asked us, he said, so you guys are so smart, why are we still making vaccine in eggs? So the next question was, how can we really modernize the vaccine development process to make it faster so that when this happens again, we don't have to wait months to get a new vaccine out? Exactly the right question to ask, and we subsequently have delivered another report, and we were thankfully had a little longer time to work on that, about new directions in vaccine technology. But the topics are not all just healthcare. As a matter of fact, many of them are about environmental issues, about energy sources, new energy sources, about nanotechnology, about nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons technology and arms control and economics and just a whole anything you can think of in the broad rubric of science and technology is fair game for the kind of reports we do.
What has the PCAST, President's Council, come up with where new energy sources and environment are concerned? I mean, I know that's a big question.
There are active studies going on about climate change and about developing ways to accelerate the development of new kinds of energy sources. The ones that have been released, most of those are still ongoing, but the ones that have been released are on the website, and your listeners can just get PCAST.gov, go to PCAST.gov, and there's a website there, and all of those, the reports that have been released and the ones that are in progress are listed.
And I think one of the battles we're still fighting, and we're fighting it on a state level here in New Mexico and still on a national level, is the seriousness and urgency of climate change as a national and international issue. It sounds like the president and this group gets that.
Totally.
And
totally.
What about really disseminating that to the rest of the country?
Well, that, as you know, has become a kind of a political football, unfortunately, because the president totally does get it. He knows the science, and some of my colleagues on PCAST are some of the real eminent experts in this area. And so we have been doing reports that have looked at the various models for how to mitigate climate change and how to adapt to some of the new threats that it's posing, as well as to try to shift the curve away from using fewer hydrocarbons and finding ways to restore more of a natural balance in the carbon dioxide economy. So those are all scientific questions. And one of the interesting things about this role of being a science advisor is that, you know, the president's job is to deal with the politics of it. And he has some very good people doing that. It's very tough for all of the reasons that your listeners know very well. But what he asks us for is, well, what is really the best science here? And then that gets folded into the political process. So we don't advise him on the politics of it. We just answer his questions about the science.
Right. We're talking to Dr. Christine Castle. We have just a few minutes left, and I was wondering if you could tell us about your experience with geriatric patients. Who are the people who stay healthiest into old age, who have happy, healthy 70s, 80s, and 90s. Is there anything that you can see as a pattern that they do or that they ways that they live?
Absolutely. This is something that's been dubbed successful aging, and I think all of us aspire to that. Many people think, well, it's in the genes, you know, and because I have my family history of X, Y, or Z, then that I'm going to end up like that. Actually, less than 30% of what gets factored into how well you age is actually genetically determined. So you have a lot of control in your life about how healthy you're going to be as you age. Now, mind you, this is all statistical, so that, you know, bad things can happen and a person can, you know, have some medical event that they couldn't have predicted. So you can't totally control everything. But there's very, very good data now that people who are physically active and mentally active and socially active, and the social part of it is an interesting one too, that staying engaged in society, and even particularly as people face retirement, that it's very important to stay active and engaged and stimulated as part of your environment. Some of the complexity networking data has shown that, actually. But let's talk about physical activity. People think, oh, that means I have to go to the gym and sweat for an hour every day. Wrong. That's not really what you need. You need to do just simple things during the day, like, you know, park a little farther away from the grocery store and walk. Or walk your dog. There you go. And actually, having pets has been shown to have a very beneficial effect. Probably especially with dogs, because you need to get out and walk.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have this huge epidemic of obesity in the country right now, and that's a real detriment to healthy aging, because not only is it bad for your heart, but it's bad for your joints, it gives you diabetes, it gives you high blood pressure, and then all those things are risks for not just shortened lifespan, but, you know, more serious medical conditions. So if people can avoid overweight, eat reasonable food, I mean, I think there's not a single right answer to this diet or that diet. Basically, eat less and less processed food, I think, and more vegetables and fruit, and stay active.
When you talk about socially, mentally, and physically active, I think of a kind of tribal model where an older person is a very important part of a community and is looked to and still participates in the daily life and the social occasions of the tribe.
Absolutely. And this is something that I hope, as somebody who's headed into that time of my own life, I have colleagues who've really promoted and led this thing, particularly for women, because women still live longer than men. So women are more likely to be widowed or, you know, to be living alone as they get older. That rather than people should come together in groups and support groups and retirement communities, etc. But the worst thing would be not to have intergenerational connections and not to really include people in every aspect of life. Hey, let's face it, you know, 10 years, one out of every five people in this country, 20%, are going to be over the age of 65. So you can't marginalize, you know, one out of every five people. So everybody that you're going to be seeing in the airport, in the stores, in the movies, you know, in sports, is going to be older people. And many of them are healthy, particularly if we can manage this obesity thing. I think many of us are going to be healthier as we get older.
Dr. Castle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.